And we're going to continue with our tribute to several coast-to-coast guests who have passed on. They've joined the other side. I'm sure they're still looking to the problems and the heavens for answers, no doubt. And perhaps wherever they may be, they have those answers now. We're going to come back with another special guest next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Fred Bell has appeared numerous times on Coast to Coast. He mysteriously died on September 25th, 2011, of what they call natural causes. But a lot of people believe that is not the case. He was somewhat controversial. Dr. Bell is the author of many books, most recently a bestseller called Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. A former NASA scientist, he worked with the late Wernher von Braun. He was a consultant to more than 3,000 high-tech companies before he started Paradigm. And although he is in celebrity management at the time of his death, he still runs the company Paradigm when he was alive and still has those government ties as well. Now, at the age of 14, he went to work for the government on a project called MK Ultra. He was a musician, film producer. He believed that music and imagery gets the word out quickly. He's right about that. Involved in the Project Awareness program. Here is my recent interview several years ago with Dr. Fred Bell. Fred, how are you?
Hey, George. I've got a little bit of a rough throat because I was up in L.A. and I did that lecture and stuff. Sorry I missed your luncheon.
Oh, that's right. You were there. That's right. I was looking for you.
Yeah, I wanted to be there, but I didn't get there till Monday, and you were already gone. Then last year, it was so divine because you had the honorarium to Zachariah Sitchin. And that little guy, he just loved you so much. And
oh, my gosh, we miss him.
Yeah, we do. And I'm sure he's in a much happier place now. If I were him and all the controversy that he stirred up, and after that luncheon that you presented for him with all those famous people, I think he was probably in heaven from that point on.
Let me tell you what's so funny about the course. Zechariah passed away several months after that event, and
right.
I was so happy that we had that opportunity to give him that Lifetime Achievement Award. But this year it went to Danion Brinkley.
Oh, my God, Damien's an old buddy.
Yeah, and Danion's speech was, the last person they gave this to died. I hope I'm a little luckier.
Yeah, I think Damien, well, he's already been dead once now.
Yeah, more than that. Yeah,
absolutely. He bounces back.
Absolutely. Do you miss the aerospace industry at all, or do you love doing what you've been doing?
Well, you know what? Do I miss it? No. Yes and no, for two reasons. I'm still connected with it. Gene Curcio is a good friend of mine. He was the founder of Emmerstat and a couple of big satellite companies. And I still have friends there, and I still get, information from there. But would I work there? No. Had great laboratories to play in. Today I have my own laboratory, so I've been able to accumulate, through surplus and that stuff that I had. So, yeah, but it was fun. I mean, when I worked for Von Braun, well, first of all, when I worked for Scott Crossfield, he was the X-15 guy, that was over at SNID Space and Information Division in Downey, California, and I got to sit in all the 13 different Apollo modules because I was a checkout engineer on those. So I'd sit in the middle seat, and I'd switch all the switches, and that was fun. I mean, I was a young guy, though, Then we got down to Seal Beach and we worked on a Saturn. I started to see the political side of it, and then it wasn't so much fun anymore. I had mixed feelings.
We're going to go 3 hours with you. If the voice starts to go, you let me know.
No,
okay?
It's fine. I got water here. I'll easily go 3 hours.
Very good. Well,
I'm in perfect health. It's just sometimes when you talk a bit, it's like a singer. Sometimes they have to shut down for a week.
You're a holistic guy. You should have honey next to you
that
stuff.
I do. I've been taking some oxycodone and a bunch of stuff. I'm fine.
Well, I've got to tell you, though, we talked over the last couple days.
Yeah.
How many people have been sick lately?
Oh, yeah.
Coming down with all kinds of things. Yeah. See, this is weird. This is weird. I mean, I chastised the World Health Organization last year, Fred, for that. They claimed that the H1N1 virus was going to be a pandemic and, millions of deaths and everything. And, it fizzled out. It never happened. I think it was
well, that's
a hoax.
A scam. Yeah, we can talk about them all you want. 1947, they were set up. Yeah, they're a bunch. That's a spinoff of Tavistock. That's what they do.
But now people are getting sick and it doesn't go away.
No.
And it just lingers and lingers, and then it comes back.
Yeah, it's swine flu, and these were invented, in army bases back on the East Coast a long time ago. But the thing is, they have different agents in them that when your immune system gets past so many genetic transmutations of dealing with the immune system, they reintroduce another virus that was not in the original, but they're like hidden viruses, and that's part of the science of the eradication of the human race. So they have these hidden viruses. I work with a guy named Jeff Sutherland, who's world famous. He's worked on our QBAM project, and I've learned these different viral codes. It goes actually back to some of the early work that was done at the turn of the century when everybody was being persecuted. But yes, it is it's beautiful how they script. These things are basically scripted, and all I can say is they're scripted genetic design viruses. And they do go away, but you got to know how to fight them.
Yeah, absolutely. Your new work, The Inside Track, The Complete History of Science, and you key in on a lot of things that government is trying to do to us.
Right.
And it's worldwide. Tell me a little bit about what you've been seeing, Fred, what you're sensing that's happening out there.
Well, what I see is, first of all, I grew up as a scientist, a young scientist, and being, developing neurostimulation gear that was used by the CIA back in the 50s, along with Stephen Ehrenbaugh. And that was my first taste of the government. And that's when they took over that stuff, the devices, the neurostimulation devices and the oscilloscope monitors that we did on the EEG monitors on the brain. When they took over that, they put a secret clearance on me. And I didn't even know what the secret clearance meant. And so over the years, I've had a lot of, that's why I wrote The Inside Track, and I was able to reflect on a lot of my companies, like iTech, that was a CIA-run company, a lot of CIA-run companies, and a lot of normal companies, like Hughes Aircraft, and how, when I'd go into these companies, calling on them as a consultant, say Hughes Aircraft had five different blocks, five different buildings. Each one has the need to know. But with me, I went into building one, building two, and building three, and I was, advised of their project, so I got to see the big picture. And that's sort of how it started. That is basically how it started. And since then, I began to see, when there was times in my younger days, I'd go into psych wards in these hospitals, and sometimes I'd go to old army bases where they were conducting, experiments mm-hmm. on human beings. And I saw horrible things. I really did. And I can go into details, but that was kind of the overview of it. And then when I got over to the satellite stuff, and I was working in Autonetics on the ILS, which became Star Wars, then I got the big picture. And then finally, when I started to see these keyhole satellites go up, starting with the one in 1991 on STS-38, I realized what was the big picture was. And then I talked to my buddies and got inside tracks on the different satellites and what they really did, not just internet and all that.
Well, over the past few years, Fred, we've been getting information finally that talks about how government has done secret testing over citizens, secret testing over soldiers.
Yeah.
And back in the 60s and the 70s, even the 50s, if people had heard this, they would have said that's nonsense. No. Government would never do that to anybody.
I know, the government has been so deceptive since Roswell, as far as I'm concerned. They have been so deceptive. They really have. I have seen it. I've been a part of it. That's why I wrote that Inside Track book. It's like you just have to confess. I didn't know. I mean, I was duped. I thought we were doing some really cool stuff, and now it's turned against people. And once I began studying holistic medicine and how the electrical processes of the bodies work and the auras and the frequencies, I realized that some of these medical labs that I used to call in that were CIA-operated were doing the same thing, and I just wasn't paying attention to exactly what they were doing, but I was supplying them, monitoring equipment for the human psyche and all those kinds of things. So today I can realize what it's all about, and now I've got the big picture.
Well, you probably thought they were doing great humanitarian things.
Yeah, yeah. And then on the other side of it, when I joined the National Health Federation, it was started by Thomas Colson and Fred Hart, and that was, they were standing on the shoulders of a lot of people that were persecuted by not the government, not then the FDA, from the 1800s up. Even some of them had patents because basically they were saying electrical stimulus has a great effect on the cellular structures of the body, and you can manipulate this in a good and bad way, and they were doing it in a good way. And, of course, up until the 1980s, the government finally turned around, publicly and admitted, yeah, this stuff's all real. And these Swiss companies over there in Switzerland are doing this pulse electromagnetic pulsing, to clear blockages in in your body that cause pain from sitting at a computer too long, when you get that cramp in your arm, that kind of stuff. And you see, and these things cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're completely legitimate today. That's the good side of it. Now, just realize the other side of the coin is not the good side of it. You know?
When did this start to change? I mean, you mentioned Roswell. Was that the event that made government decide to be deceptive?
I think it was because in the first day, you know, they admitted that there was a spaceship that crashed. And, you know, I got insight on that one because of my friend Clay Davis. Clay Davis, he was working with me at NASA in 1963 at Seal Beach, 64. And I told Clay Davis, I told him about Roswell. And his dad worked under Atwood, who was the vice president of North America at that time, Clay Davis Jr., and he was a senior engineer in development. So I told Clay, I said, you know, up there at Roswell, I know that was a real ship that crashed, and I know that there were bodies and they were examined and confiscated by the government. And so Clay, he didn't believe me. You know, he's a real smart young engineer, hot head. So he went home and told his dad.
And most people would not believe you at that time.
No, they would not believe me. So, but Clay went back and told his dad, who was a director under Atwood, who was vice president of North American Rockwell, and that was a big position in those days. And his comment, Clay Sr. says, "Yeah, Fred Bell's telling you the truth. I was one of the 18 specialists that went out there, and I saw those bodies." And he said, "We had one guy was a dentist, one guy was a this and that." He named all the things off. And he was one of the technical guys representing Rockwell, because Rockwell, of course, was contracting, you know, everything from the, you know, Super Sabres to the P-51. So they were heavily involved with Rockwell in the government. And he says, so Clay Jr. comes back the next day. He says, "I apologize." He says, "Fred," he says, "my dad verified what you said. You're not a nut anymore." And I had a completely different relationship with this kid from that for the rest of our lives, you know, even now. So.
Do you know if Rockwell got any instrumentation to try to do some reverse engineering?
I'm sure they did. But, you know, I was also an employee of Lockheed earlier. Actually, after that, I went to Lockheed for a little while. Kelly Johnson was, you know, he was a homeboy from Ann Arbor. And Lockheed had the real heads up on that, because they were doing some advanced propulsion systems even before the reverse engineering stuff came along. So I'm very sure that Lockheed was probably one of the leaders in that. Rockwell was kind of a, you know, Rockwell overall was pretty good. We built the F1 engines for the Saturn, which are 1 million pound thrust out of Santa Ana in California and all those places. And Rockwell, you know, Autonetics Division pioneered microcircuitry. But as far as alien technology, I didn't see them doing that much. I saw other companies doing more.
Let's talk about the key factors of the book, The Inside Track. Tell me about holograms, first of all, Fred.
Okay.
Explain how they work.
Okay. This is where I got to take some time on this one to get it right, you know, where people understand it. But, you know, for a long time, we looked at the body as a cellular structure. And then we got into electricity. Oh, my God, the brain emits, you know, electrical pulses. And that creates an aura field. And the aura field does things, and you can communicate with other humans. And so then we got into studies of, you know, telepathy and all these kinds of things. The Russians were great leaders in this field.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, physicists like David Bohm came along, and he said, he died in 92, but he was one of the first perpetuators in physics of what the, you know, hologram was all about. And then another, Dr. Prebrum came along, and he was checking with rats. He was looking at rats. And he was cutting their brains up and putting them back in their head and doing all, and then running them through the mazes. And what he found was that even if he ground up a rat's brain and stuck it back in his head, he would still somewhat function. Now, if you did that to a human being, you would obviously destroy their intellectual capacity.
Sure.
But you wouldn't destroy their memory. So memory becomes part of the hologram. The hologram is something that has the ability to grow. And when we start talking about growing, you know, it's like I met you at a certain point, and we met each other, and we've done these shows together over a long period of time, and we have a connection. Even before you called, I was listening to Stevie Nicks, and I was saying, there's George playing Stevie Nicks. Stevie Nicks was one of my greatest skeptics when I first started Paradigm.
Yeah.
We became great friends. And then even your show tonight earlier, you were just so many nerves. So we're on the same wavelength on so many things. Okay, so that creates between us a quantum connection, as we would call it today. Now, a few years ago, when you're looking at a DLOR healing machine or radionics machine, you put a sample in it, and something would happen, like a picture, and something would be affected, like maybe insects were killed in an orchard, miles away. People didn't know the proper terminology of how to describe what was happening. But when the hologram was introduced, and when within the hologram, it has to have an illumination. A hologram is created, for example, by a three-axis laser scanning an object if you're looking at a visual hologram. But in life, a hologram is made by the interaction of energies between us and other people. And this, as these energies take place, becomes what's called quantum entanglement. And once that connection is made, it's there forever. You cannot untangle it. It doesn't work. And then the physicist Alan Aspect demonstrated that you could split light in two directions and control the polarity of both beams going in the opposite direction at any distance in space and time. This was a big breakthrough in quantum physics, defining what the hologram was. So the hologram basically is an illusion. It's, if I picked up a chair and I said, "Hey, George, where did chairs come from?" You would restore to resort to your historical ability to realize maybe a chair came from Holland or something,
Sure.
You know what I mean? In some basic time and place. So all of this starts to build up. And the beauty of the hologram is, as all of this intelligentsia builds up and combines and intermodulates and creates a perfect energy within itself, it doesn't go away ever. And if you were to look at this as a big pie and cut into a piece of pie, it's a cherry pie, and you take that cherry apart and you cut the seed apart, every element of that seed is the same thing as the entire contents of the pie.
Well, is the hologram, Fred, then literally capturing a structure or something, an object, and then it's projecting what it looks like wherever you want to project it?
No, it's not where you want to project it, unless you're the military and you're using warfare. It's already there. You just have to become conscious of what it is. And that's where these deep, forms of meditation and things that the Eastern people do, and we do here, it's being able to comprehend and reach a knowingness in the soul of your existence, in the soul of your body. You've got to reach this knowingness to really work with the hologram. I mean, yeah, you can look at 3D TV now. Okay, everybody's going to get a 3D TV. Okay, there's a hologram that you can see with glasses on.
Right. Okay.
But life is a hologram. You don't need glasses. You just have to see it that way. And of course, it's hard to, because we get attached to it.
Another guest that I truly miss, Dr. Fred Bill. Years ago, he gave me a pyramid, two pyramids basically stuck back together. And I have always used it as an earthquake detector. It is in my studio in Los Angeles, connected by a wire. And when it only moves if the building is shaking. And a week or so ago, I was in the midst of that 5-point-plus earthquake that hit in Southern California. And I came into the studio, and I looked at the pyramid, and the thing was just going back and forth. And I said, "We just had an earthquake." And sure enough, we did. In a moment, one more past guest on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Jimmy Church filling in for me tomorrow while I go off to the Lindenwood University for the rehearsal for the Saturday event. So make sure you're listening. He's going to have a great show for you, by the way. And next week, my guest during the week will be Ian Punnett. That's right. We're going to be chatting with him about some of the things that he has been up to. But this is my last opportunity to talk to you about the St. Louis event. It is Saturday, June 18th. Full information at coasttocoastam.com. You can get your tickets online. You can pick your own seats. Those of you who cannot get to the St. Louis area, the promoter has a little pay-per-view system set up that you can watch in the comfort of your home if you want to. So that would be interesting as well. And then, of course, in August, Asheville, North Carolina, our live event at the Diana Wortham Theater. That's going to be great. William Forstian will be there on EMPs. Micah Hanks on UFOs, and paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren joins us. You could get full information there by going to coasttocoastam.com as well. And welcome back to Coast, our final guest who passed away in April of 2014 at the age of 63 was an American writer, musician, Los Angeles Police Department officer, investigative journalist, political activist, wrote a book in 2004 called Crossing the Rubicon, Michael Rupert, a great guest. They found him dead with what they say was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. I had this incredible opportunity to chat with him back around 2004. Let's chat a little bit about all these things that are going on, but give all of us an understanding of who Michael Rupert is.
Well, if you were to ask me privately, which of course we're not now, but I would probably say I was a guy who had really bad luck. I was born into a family with very deep intelligence connections. My mother had been a cryptanalyst for the Army Security Agency, which was a forerunner of the NSA during World War II. Her work product was viewed by Secretary of State Cordell Hull throughout World War II. She had, of course, the highest clearances possible. She had worked on Japanese codes and Russian to attract Russian nuclear scientists up until she left in about 1949, 1950. My father had been an Air Force officer who went to work for Martin Marietta on projects related to CIA programs, notably the Titan IIIC, which puts up the keyhole spy satellites. Relatives of my dad's were career at CIA headquarters in Langley. Everybody in the family had a clearance. I was born in Washington, D.C., into that environment. Moved quite heavily until I was a junior in high school, where we came to Los Angeles. When I graduated from Venice High School in 69, I started interning for LAPD. I knew that I wanted to be a policeman even before I had gone to college. And LAPD ran a background check and found out that I had a Q clearance just because I lived in the same house with my mother
and
father.
Right.
And so quickly I was interning for the chief of police. And I was getting some very choice assignments. I was an honor student, and I was chosen to intern for the chief. And the CIA tried to recruit me once officially when I was a senior. I did not accept the invitation. I did not go to work for CIA. Joined LAPD in 1973, was valedictorian of my academy class, hit the streets in South Central, was promoting rapidly, and a second recruitment effort occurred through a very beautiful woman who became my fiance. That was a little different than the first one.
Right.
And it was through that I was exposed to the fact that CIA was actively involved in bringing drugs into the U.S., saw those arrangements being made with my own eyes, refused to get involved in that, terminated the relationship, and tried to blow the whistle, but I don't think anybody really wanted to listen to me then. I didn't realize how deeply CIA was wired in through major police departments throughout the country, including my own. And as a result of that, I'd been shot at, was threatened, burglarized, harassed, and I got a death threat in November of 1978, which I tape recorded. I asked to see our chief of police then, Daryl Gates, and received a message back. Well, he's real busy. He can give you 5 or 10 minutes in a week to 10 days. If you're still alive, would you like to make an appointment? That's when I resigned. Those experiences have determined the course of my life, really, from that day to this.
Would you have been forced out of the police department, Michael, had you not resigned?
Well, I think I would have been shot had I not resigned. I had been placed in a position where, as a police officer, I had fewer rights than I did as a citizen. I had a very wonderful attorney. We had a great paper trail. And by resigning and getting on record with the FBI locally, with some politicians locally, we kind of created an insurance policy for me. Had I chosen to shut up, I might have retired a couple years ago as a deputy chief, but I just couldn't do that.
Why not? Why couldn't you just say, you know what, I can't fight this, and I'm just going to do the best I can for myself?
Well, I'm one of those crazy fools that kind of has to believe in what he's doing, that kind of has to believe in the rightness of what he's doing, and what I had seen told me that something was fundamentally broken deep in the bowels of the U.S. government and the way the U.S. worked as a country, as a nation. It was a serious problem that could not have occurred without the highest levels of approval. I didn't understand all of how, you know, the hundreds of billions of dollars in drug cash was moved into Wall Street and through U.S. banks or any of that at the time. But I just knew that what I had seen was wrong, and that if I really wanted to go after bad guys, I was going after the wrong ones.
I must have been in St. Louis when I remember a story breaking in the Los Angeles Times about the CIA and drug trafficking and things they wanted to do with people and kids and gangs in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Were you behind that story?
No, I had really gone on record back in 1978, I think was 79 was my first contact with the LA Times. I was used extensively on a number of stories as a source, a background source. But I wasn't directly connected with stories that broke in the LA Times. Now, in 1996, however, Gary Webb, a Pulitzer Prize winner from the San Jose Mercury News, broke a great series of stories directly tying with documents the CIA to the crack cocaine epidemic. I did get very much involved in the controversy that erupted after that and had a face-to-face confrontation with then-CIA director John Deutsch on ABC Nightline television all over the world, and basically left him a stumbling, bumbling, babbling, hand-wringing guy up on the podium not knowing how to respond when I confronted him with names of specific CIA operations and said I had documents showing that they were real.
One of the, I believe, strengths of this program, Michael, and you know me from our chats in the Midwest, mm-hmm. is, you know, I'm not going to stick my head in the sand. And if there's a great story, if there's a important guest, I'm going to get them on this program, and I'm going to let the nation hear this person, make up their own minds. And you are one of those, one of the most controversial people I think we've had on Coast to Coast. I want you to address one thing of a couple people who have emailed me today, and they merely say, Michael Rupert is anti-American. And I want to give you that opportunity to address that first, clear the air about that, about some of the things that we may or may not talk about tonight, but I want you at least to be able to explain yourself to some of those who believe that because of the things you've done, the allegations you've made, they claim that you're anti-American.
Well, if it is anti-American to believe that the Constitution is a document which should be inviolate, then I guess I'm anti-American. We've lost parts of the first, fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution since 9/11. If it's un-American to believe that committing crimes is wrong, then I'm un-American. If it's un-American to believe in a sense of fair play for whoever is involved, of whatever race, creed, color, religion, nationality, then I'm un-American. I don't even think in terms of that, because the America that I was taught to believe in was a nation of fair play. It was a nation of rules and principles that could not be compromised. That was the great safety that was provided for all Americans in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that made us different, supposedly, and set us apart. I am an American. I'm fighting for the health, the safety, the mental health of my country at a time when it seems to be really challenged.
Next week, I'm going to have several guests on as we talk about the secret societies. I want to ask you this, Michael. Do you believe that among the things we're going to talk about tonight, which includes what's going on with the drugs, oil, 9/11, mm-hmm. do you believe, as some do, that a lot of this is influenced by this very secret shadow group, call it the Illuminati, call it whatever you want, but that these people, whomever they may be, maybe heads of corporations, those who benefit from things like this, but they're the ones really calling the shots here. Do you think that's true?
Well, you will never hear me as a journalist, as an investigator. I mean, my publication is read by 35 members of Congress and at 30 universities around the world. You will never hear me use or publish the term Illuminati. The reason for that is that I have never seen any documentation that is verifiable evidence that this organization exists. You will hear me talk about the Council on Foreign Relations. You will hear me talk about the Trilateral Commission. You will hear me talk about the Bilderbergers,
mm-hmm.
Because we can prove that those organizations exist. But I often am asked this question in lectures. I've lectured in 8 countries, some 39 times since 9/11. And this is one of the most frequently asked questions that I get. And what I say is, if I ever meet a guy who is at the same time a Mason, a member of Opus Dei of the Catholic Church, a member of Skull and Bones, a member of Knights of Malta, a member of the Mafia, a member of Propaganda Due, or any of these other groups, who is a member of all of them, I'll shoot him on the spot because I know I found Mr. Big. I don't see one single secret society as being the root cause of everything. What I see is the way money works is as being the governing factor in the current paradigm.
Money has become the greed factor for all of this, hasn't it?
Always my basic question is, show me how the money works. That's what I want to know.
And it's as if they have a thirst for more and more and more. I mean, what can you do when you're worth $1 billion? Why do you need $2 billion?
Well, because somebody else may have 2.3 and you have envy, I guess. You know.
Well, I look forward to this chat with you tonight. You know, originally I wanted to start off by talking about what's going on with the oil situation and some of those companies behind this. But because of Bin Laden's late-minute apparent statement tonight that he wants a treaty and a truce with Europe but not the United States, let's talk a little bit about what's happening and get your take on 9/11 and everything else. But let's go back a little bit further, if we can, mm-hmm. because to a lot of Americans, the name Osama bin Laden really didn't come up until 9/11. I mean, many people in this country just didn't know who this person was until that horrible day.
Right.
However, he'd been known to this country for years. So let's talk a little bit about that relationship. What do you know about this country's relationship with Osama bin Laden years gone back?
Well, we first started reporting on bin Laden in 1998. And if you go to the website, we have a great search engine, and type his name in, you'll find our stories back from 1998, which at the time had tied him, of course, he was a hot topic after the embassy bombings in East Africa. But we reported at the time that there were direct links between Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network and security support for the Kosovo Liberation Army, which at the time was an ally of the United States.
Correct.
Wesley Clark, as commander of NATO, was supporting the KLA. And that was at a point in time when Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law was one of the chief security advisors for the KLA, and members of Al-Qaeda were, in fact, fighting with the KLA. This at a time when the KLA was controlling some 70% of the heroin, according to the Christian Science Monitor, that was entering Western Europe. Bin Laden as an individual, his first show on the radar screen goes back to the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in 1979. He turned up in Afghanistan to fight with the Mujahideen in about 1983, I believe it was. He was taken under the protective custody of Prince Turki, who was the chief of Saudi intelligence, some Pakistani officials, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was one of the CIA's chief warlords, where his family, his construction business, was used to construct a great many bunkers, caves, storage facilities, etc., in Afghanistan. So the CIA was working with bin Laden as far back as the mid-1980s. There's an excellent record of this that's been well established.
Did we funnel billions of dollars and or arms to him to try to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan?
Well, I would not say it's correct to say that we gave them directly to bin Laden. No. His role at the time was as a construction guy and a financier. His family is enormously wealthy.
Yes.
Very few people in America know that the bin Laden group of companies in Saudi Arabia owns and operates, I think it's something like 14 satellites relaying cell phone calls. They operate car dealerships, soft drink franchises. They are a major multinational conglomerate, one of the largest companies in Saudi Arabia. So Osama, who has, I think, something like 23 brothers and sisters, comes from this family. So he showed up in Afghanistan. He didn't receive, I don't think, the Stingers and the other weapons directly. The Mujahideen did. I don't think he was working as a combatant at the time.
Was he liked by the United States during that period?
I don't think, when you talk in terms of covert operations, and I've known a great many CIA people, I still talk to CIA people, they don't think in terms of like. All they think in terms of is useful. He was definitely useful.
My enemy of my enemy, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, he contributes to getting the Soviets out after spending at least 10 years fighting the Afghans. The Soviets decided, hey, we're getting out of this game. Mm-hmm. And they decide to hightail it back to whatever was left of their country before that broke up. What happens to bin Laden then? I mean, you know, the Soviets are out. What does he do?
Well, he kind of dropped off the radar screen for a while. He started surfacing, from what I can glean, in the early 1990s, after the U.S. was invited onto Saudi soil as a result of Desert Storm 1, for fanatical Muslims. The presence of quote-unquote Gentiles or infidels on holy soil is an insult. And as the U.S. opened military bases in Saudi Arabia, that became a source of anger for a great many Muslim activists. Bin Laden's name starts to turn up then. It's a very strange coincidence, ironically, that the first country, however, to put out a warrant on him was Libya.
Yeah, Gaddafi's Libya.
Yeah. Yeah. Because bin Laden was supposedly going to kill Gaddafi. He started to gain prominence throughout the 90s. Now, ostensibly, his family says that they severed ties with him, I think, in about 1996, which is really a bunch of bunk. I have a book coming out this summer called Truth and Lies of 9/11, America's Descent into Fascism at the End of the Age of Oil. And in that book, I completely deconstruct the myth that he was disowned by his family.
So that was Michael Rupert, and that concludes our Coast Dead People's program. There are many, many more. For Dent Galante, Tom Danheiser, Donna Walker, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.